Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 56 of the Bomber Brothers podcast, brought to you, as always, by the Pinstripe Alley community of podcasts. Sean and Ryan here recording at nighttime instead of the morning because in classic quarantine fashion, neither of us realized what day of the week it was until noon, which was pretty funny. You texted me this morning, Sean. You were like, oh, shit, I forgot. Didn't realize today was Thursday and we were supposed to record. And I didn't even know it was Thursday until that text.
Yeah, we were sharing memes at work of quarantine memes, and somebody posted one where, you know, like it's the one from The Hangover where all their equations are his head, and it's like trying to figure out if tomorrow is Thursday or June. So I thought that was appropriate for what we dealt with this morning.
Yeah, but we're here now. We're overcoming the mishap, and we have a guest this week. We talked to Peter Boddy. He recently came out with his book, The Big 50, which recounts the biggest men and moments behind the New York Yankees. And we discussed a lot of highlights about his top 50, which obviously that's a tough task, confining it to just 50, given the franchise. And like Peter said in the interview, this is part of a series of books that other authors participate in. And I'm sure it's probably easier to keep it to 50 if it's a team like, you know, I was about to say a team like the Rays, but that would be really hard because then you have to get to 50. I'm thinking of it in terms of difficulty in keeping it to 50, but a team like the Pirates or something like that.
Yeah.
So, we'll go ahead and start off with that interview. For everyone listening, be sure to keep listening after we talk to Peter, because we're going to continue our season look back series this week with 2007, which was, you know, it obviously was not the best ending, but I thought was actually one of the more fun years because it was one of the rare times where the Yankees actually had to fight just to get into the playoffs, which is something that we hadn't experienced much up to that point because the Yankees were always winning the division or comfortably ahead in the wild card race. So 2007 was a memorable year for me, at least.
I agree.
All right, so before we get into that, here is Peter Boddy on his book, The Big 50, which is out now. Everyone can get it now. It came out last week, I believe, and here is Peter.
Welcome back, everybody. We're joined now by Peter Boddy. You can catch his work at the New York Post, SNY. You can also catch his new book, The Big 50, which covers everything in Yankees history, all the pivotal teams, players, moments, and that is out now. Peter, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us about your new book.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate you having me on.
And one of the best parts about the book is it covers so many prominent players in Yankees history, but also just does it in a new light and helps you think about new things. For instance, there's a chapter on Don Mattingly, which got Sean and I thinking, You know, where do you think Don Mattingly ranks in Yankee history among the best Yankee players never to win a World Series? I know for us, some other ones that came to mind were Mike Mussina or Jason Giambi. Just where do you think Mattingly ranks in those Yankee players to never win a ring?
Well, especially because, you know, dating back to Babe Ruth in the 20s, really all of the superstars in Yankee history, you know, attained at least one World Series championship. They won so many in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 90s, that most of the stars on the team who played, you know, a long time with the franchise would have won at least one World Series. I think Mattingly, you always hear it in golf, right? The greatest player never to win a major, and until somebody does it, that label kind of sticks with them. I think Mattingly would have to rank ahead of Mussina and Giambi because those guys were kind of mercenary, hired gun type free agent signings who didn't play their whole careers with the Yankees. Mattingly did, played alongside Dave Winfield for that whole, during the 80s. And Winfield would obviously is another Hall of Famer that fell short of winning a championship in New York. But Mattingly, I think, would have to be at the top of the list. And it's kind of like a backhanded compliment, right? Like you're the best of that classification, and you shouldn't hold it against Mattingly that the Yankees didn't win a World Series title in that era. I mean, he was one of the dominant players in baseball, you know, during those years. The Yankees just never had the pitching to win at all.
And he came so close in his final year in 95 before they're bounced by the Mariners in a crazy Game 5. And then the Yankees win it all the next season in 1996. And the 96 team is the first team that you mentioned in the book in one of the earlier ones. I think it's number 12 of your Big 50. And that was obviously the team that started the most recent dynasty in Yankee history. Just, you know, looking back and writing about the 96 Yankees, where do you think that team stands in terms of the most important teams in Yankee history, a franchise that has had so many?
Well, that really started kind of the latest dynasty we've seen in baseball. They won four out of five years, and they came within a Luis Gonzalez bloop of winning a fifth in 6 years in 2001. So obviously the 96 team was the start of it all. I mean, really, you could go back a few years before that when Stick Michael was kind of running the team while George Steinbrenner was suspended and, you know, decided to start holding on to some of the prospects that would have been traded in the earlier decade. You know, in the 80s, they traded away guys like Fred McGriff and Willie McGee and Doug Drabeck and Jose Rijo and just on and on. Guys never really kind of made it to the Yankees and stayed. When they kept Bernie Williams in the early 90s, that was the beginning of them kind of leaning on the homegrown guys again. And then obviously we know what happened with Jeter and with Jeter and Pettit and Posada and Mariano, you know, coming out of the system after that. But I think that 96 team, the reason I had them ranked ahead of the 20, I mean, obviously everybody knows that the 27 Yankees and the 98 Yankees are two of the great teams in franchise history, but I had just written so much about Ruth and Gehrig and players from the older eras that I wanted to get the 96 team up there prominently. And I figured, even though I know the 98 team was the better team than the 96 team, I thought the 96 team obviously was the reason. There would be no 98 team without that 96 team, and even losing the next year in 97 to Cleveland. But that was the arrival of Joe Torre, it was the arrival of Jeter, and really was the arrival of Mariano as a force, even though he was on the 95 team that lost to Seattle in the playoffs. But that was the year that Mariano kind of emerged as this dominant setup man that the Yankees really didn't know what they had. Even, coming into that season, ended up being a dominant setup man for Wetland. And then when Wetland left as a free agent the next year, Mariano took over as the closer and ended up being the greatest closer in baseball history.
And Peter, another team that you bring up in your 50 is the 1999 championship team, which I don't know about you, but I feel like it gets overlooked. When you were writing this, do you also think the 99 team gets overlooked? Because they were really good that year, only lost one game in the postseason, and not a lot of people talk about that team.
And that was a very different year, guys, from the 98 team, which was really kind of a steamroll after the first week of the season when they started, you know, 1-4 and George was going crazy and Cashman got ordered off the road trip. 99 was a very different season, really, from the beginning. At the start of spring training, they trade David Wells, who had thrown a perfect game in 98, to Toronto with Graham Lloyd and Homer Bush for Roger Clemens. And it was kind of a a moment where the, you know, the Yankees thought, all right, we're not, you know, and Cashman and George Steinbrenner thought, we're not going to sit idly on this ridiculous 125 win season we just had. We want to always look to improve the team. So they trade for Clemens, and then also in spring training, Joe Torre gets diagnosed with cancer and has to leave the team for treatment for a little while, you know, into the first month plus of the regular season. And so Don Zimmer takes over as manager, and it wasn't as easy a season as 98 was, but 99, you know, and defeating the Braves again in the World Series, and you guys mentioned they even, in the postseason, their record was even better than it was in 98 when they were 11-2. In 99, they were 11-1. And I think that team gets overlooked somewhat because it's kind of sandwiched between the 98 squad and the 2000 team, which didn't have a great regular season, but went on to beat the Mets in the Subway Series, you know, first one since the Dodgers and Giants left town in the 50s. So the fact that I think that those are the reasons that 99 kind of gets the short end of the stick when people look back on Yankee history.
And another one of your big 50 is actually the stadium or the stadiums themselves, which do play a big part in Yankee history. You know, we grew up going to Yankee Stadium Park 2, and, you know, now we go to Yankee Stadium 3. But it felt like when Yankee Stadium 3 opened, it was very quiet, a very business-like atmosphere, and it's come alive again in the last few years. Even though the teams were very competitive in 2009 and 11, 12, why do you think it took a little while for fans to warm up to the new stadium?
And it's, I mean, they did win the World Series that first year that the stadium was open, and I think that was a big deal. But I feel like it just didn't have the kind of the history and the little nuances that the old stadium had. I mean, I was there during all those World Series runs in the late 90s and even 2001 after 9/11. Never felt any atmosphere like that in a stadium. Those two nights on back-to-back nights that Tino and Brocious hit the game-tying home runs in the ninth innings of games 4 and 5, and the Yankees went on to win both those, even though they didn't win that series. You just always kind of felt that magic. I was in the building as well for the Aaron Boone walk-off home run 2003 game 7 against the Red Sox, and the old stadium just kind of had that mystique and aura, as Curt Schilling actually said about the stadium when the ghosts come out, and the new stadium even that part of the stadium was very different from the stadium that Ruth and Gehrig and Mantle and DiMaggio played in. You know, with the 461-foot Death Valley in left center field, and it was just a very different ballpark after they renovated it in the 70s. But I think the new stadium, you know, until you get those moments, and I know the 2009 World Series was a great starting point, but they haven't been able to build on it. And, you know, it's more considered, while the old stadium was the house that Ruth built and had all the kind of spirits and different quirky things about it, the new stadium is just this monolithic, you know, billion-plus-dollar stadium that, you know, doesn't really have the personality that the old stadium did, at least for me. You know, you watch games sometimes and you see the seats empty behind the plate. You know, some of those fans don't sit there. That, you know, they sit in the restaurants inside during the games, and it kind of just doesn't have the same feel that the old stadium does. Now, not to take away from that, it's a beautiful stadium, great amenities, that, you know, every part of the experience is probably better than the old stadium, at least in terms of, you know, bathrooms and concessions and walking around the stadium and those kind of things. But I feel like the Yankees need to make their own history with this new group, with Aaron Boone and Judge and Sanchez and Glaber, and these guys kind of have to cement their own place in history for it to really become, you know, have that feeling of the old stadium again.
And you mentioned, when talking about the old stadium, games 4 and 5 of the 2001 World Series, which of course are two of the most memorable nights in that stadium's history, and also coupled together as an entry in your Big 50. And you reference a talk you had with Scott Brocious a couple years back, and he talked about just how incredible that was. When you talk to guys like Brocious and, you know, Tino's about those two nights, do you ever get a sense that they almost still can't believe what those two nights were like and that what they were able to accomplish? And do they seem to be more upset about how that World Series ended when they look back on it? Or are they more focused on those two nights where just the incredible happened two nights in a row?
I feel like among the guys that I talk to, they think of those nights as some of the greatest moments that they experienced as part of that run, even though they lost that series. Obviously, it was a tough series for them to lose Mariano on the mound with the lead in the, you know, in the final inning. So, I mean, they look back on it as a tough pill to swallow. I mean, imagine what the, I think Lee Mazzilli says in the book, like, imagine what the parade would have been like that year in New York to be able to give New York a parade or something similar, just, you know, with everything, with all the kind of gut-punching sadness that was going on in the city and in the country at that time. They think of those nights fondly. Like Brosh said, like, couldn't believe it happened the same way a second night in a row. Like, it's one thing for it to happen the first night when Tino hits the homer and Jeter hits the Mr. November home run to win it. But imagine the same pitcher on the mound in the same circumstance, and Brosh hits a tying home run the next night. He's like, I'm running around the bases thinking, I can't believe this just happened. And, you know, Torrey feels the same way about it. Like, couldn't believe what he was watching. And, you know, I feel like obviously it would have been that might have been probably the greatest World Series win just because of the importance to the city it would have had if they could have won it. But I don't think it takes away that much for those guys who were there those two nights. Like I said before, the stadium felt like it was going to fall down on both of those nights. And the second night in particular, nobody could believe what they were seeing. And it was an unbelievable atmosphere considering everything that was going on. President Bush had thrown the first pitch, you know, at the start of the home games in that series. And it was just a surreal time for everybody. And I think the Yankees definitely still look back on it fondly, even though they lost that World Series.
And one of the other great moments in your book is the Costanza chapter. The mentioning of George Costanza from Seinfeld. I was curious because, you know, Elaine obviously dates a former Met in Keith Hernandez. Of the Yankees that you've covered, which Yankee could have filled in for Keith and been a representative boyfriend for Elaine that would have brought something to the show, do you think?
Oh, that's pretty funny. I mean, I don't know if to throw out there different guys are married or whatever, but I mean, like, somebody like David Cohen is really funny, and I could see him fitting into a role like that. Jerry Seinfeld was a huge Met fan, so that's why I wanted to talk to Larry David, and I felt really fortunate to get him on the phone and talk to him for about an hour. He's such a diehard New York sports fan. He grew up in Brooklyn and grew up worshiping Mantle and those Yankees in the 50s and 60s. And so I asked him, I said, why would you guys used Keith early in the series? Why wouldn't, when you needed a job for George, why wouldn't you have had him working for the Mets? And he said, it's as simple as George Steinbrenner. They just felt like they could go so many different ways. He was the perfect kind of character that they could parody and caricature in that setting. And as we saw over the years, they really took it to extremes with Larry providing the voice for George. One funny story about that Larry tells me in the book is that George actually flew out to LA to film a couple of scenes for one of the episodes in like season 6 or 7, and George it didn't go well. They filmed it. He did some scenes with Julie Louis-Dreyfus. He offers to take her to George Costanza's wedding, and it just didn't work. And Larry and Jerry realized that from the beginning, but they had to be the ones to tell George that he was getting cut from the episode. And he took it pretty well, but it's funny that George, you know, kind of embraced him being lampooned on the show, because he didn't know much about it when they first contacted him to get his approval to use his likeness and the Yankees likeness in the show, the Yankees brand. And George did, you know, his grandchildren were the ones who kind of egged him on to do it. They were fans of the show. George actually was quoted once in the 90s as saying that his grandchildren thought it was cooler that he was on, that he was a character on Seinfeld than anything else he had accomplished in his life, including owning the Yankees, which is pretty funny. But yeah, I mean, it was such a big part. I knew from the beginning when I signed on to do the book that I wanted to try to do a chapter on George Costanza, as difficult as it was paring down the Yankees and their story history to only 50 chapters.
We're talking with Peter Boddy about his new book, The Big 50, which covers all the prominent teams, players, and historic moments in the Yankees' rich history. And Peter, there are so many moments in Yankee history. They've won more titles than any other team in sports, so I'm sure narrowing it down to 50 teams was a difficult task. Were there any, you know, fringe players or teams that you were hoping to get into the book and just realized there weren't enough room? Maybe any honorable mentions that didn't make the cut?
Definitely. When I first started, I had a list of probably 80 to 100 names of players, managers, front office people, owners, you know, specific moments, you know, World Series moments, perfect games, and then obviously the 27 championships. So it was a daunting task to narrow it down to 50. So what I told myself in the beginning, because I knew I wanted to do this Costanza chapter, but what I told myself in the beginning was that I have to put all of Babe Ruth's moments in one chapter. I have to put all Garrett's moments, DiMaggio's moments, Mantle's moments, Jeter's moments, etc., into their own chapter. Because I could do, let's face it, I could do 10 Jeter moments, I could do 10 Babe Ruth moments, and the book would be over. So I put all their, I consolidated their feats into their own chapters, and then I combined some of the World Series years. I tried to do several individual ones, especially the recent ones, but the like from 19 when they won four in a row from 1936 to 1939, I kind of made that one chapter and tied it in with Bill Dickey, who was, you know, the star catcher on those teams. He kind of bridged the Ruth Garrick teams to the DiMaggio teams, and then I also combined the five-peat from 1949 to 1953. Because it was a lot of the same players on those teams with Casey as the manager. That was the way I could narrow it down. I mean, a couple of championship years end up getting glossed over. I just put a couple of graphs about, like, say, them repeating in 1962 into the 1961 Roger Maris chapter, because I didn't have enough chapters. This is a series by Triumph Books, and they've done some other teams, and they sent me some examples when I first got the, you know, signed the contract to do the book. And, you know, like they sent me, for example, the Minnesota Twins, and not to disparage the Minnesota Twins, but the person who's number 25 or 30 in the Twins history isn't cracking the top 500 when it comes to the Yankees. So that was probably the most daunting part of it. But I feel like I covered all the bases with some combined chapters. And, you know, really, when you look at it, Ruth was traded for in 1920, and this past year was 2020. And that's where I ended the book, with chapter 50 being the Baby Bombers and their quest now to cement their own place in this, you know, storied history of this franchise.
Yeah, certainly every big moment, player, and team is covered. Again, that's Peter Boddy. You can get his book, The Big 50, The Men and Moments That Made the New York Yankees. It is out now. Peter, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us, and all the best in the book success.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. You guys stay safe.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks again to Peter Boddy. Everyone, make sure to go check out that book. It's really good and keeps things fresh while still recounting some of the more well-known people and moments behind the Yankees. And Sean, I guess before we get into 2007, if you had to pick a top three of a Big 50 for, it doesn't have to be Yankees history as a whole, but your Yankee history as a fan, what would your Big three be?
I mean, I could have spoken to Peter about George Costanza and Seinfeld, and when he told us that he talked to Larry David for an hour, I just wanted him to reiterate the whole conversation.
Yeah, I was jealous.
Yeah, I was too. All right, my top three, just like moments for the Yankees.
Well, it's the men and moments that make up the Yankees. So it could be a team, it could be a moment, it could be a player, because that's, you know, Peter did everything from, you know, game four and five of 01 to the 96 team to, you know, players like A-Rod and Babe.
I would say my three would be the Girardi triple in 96, game four and five in 2001, and Derek Jeter. Those are like the three things I probably would think about first. And, you know, Jeter's not my favorite player to put on the pinstripes ever. Definitely in the top couple. But, I mean, when I think about the Yankees and my fandom of them, he's there for pretty much 75-80% of all the moments. And, yeah, I mean, the Girardi triple in 96 is probably I mean, when you watch that and you realize what it represents in the moment, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I pretty much would have the exact same three. I mean, he kept it to teams, moments, and players, so I wanted to pick one of each, and mine would have been the 96 Yankees would be the team, the moment would be games four and five of the 0-1 World Series, and the player would be Jeter. So we've got pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, and I think you could change them out pretty easily, because I don't think either of us would argue with the other one if we said Mariano Rivera for the player.
Oh, no, of course.
Or if we said the 98 team instead of the 96 one. I mean, you know, there's no argument. You know, we got pretty lucky with what we've seen.
Yeah, and I honestly think that 2007, you know, we talked last week about how 2001, if we could pick one Yankee team in our life that didn't win the World Series – 2001 would be the easy pick for us, which I still believe. But 2007 is a sneaky one for me in terms of teams that I really wish won a World Series. I mean, I would say 2001, 2017, 2007 certainly is in the conversation for me, just because of how much they did have to fight in the regular season, which, like I said before the interview with Peter, that was kind of a rarity for us in our Yankee lifetime of being fans, is because they were almost always pretty easily getting into the playoffs, and this was not the case this year, and there was obviously plenty more going on as well. You had Joe Torre and his job fate hanging in the balance. You had Pettit back on the Yankees. You had the arrival of Jabba Chamberlain, which was so much fun. There was just a lot of stuff about this season that you were really bummed when they weren't able to get out of the first round, but I still think it was a memorable season and worth looking back on.
Yeah, it was, I mean, absolutely incredible. I mean, you think about it, they were, what, 22 and 29 at one point?
Yeah, this was the first year in I don't know how long that they had entered the All-Star break under 500.
Yeah, I think they got to 22 and 30 or something, because I know they got to eight games under 500. And They played, you know, what, 670 ball in the second half, something like that. So they had a 679 winning percentage in July, a 704 winning percentage in September. Just an absolutely insane second half, and it made it really fun to watch. And there were still some really good moments in the beginning of the season. Like, if you think about the A-Rod walk-off grand slam, walk-off three-run homer, it's not like the season in the beginning was dearth of really good moments.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I also go back to the game in June when A-Rod had the go-ahead homer off Papelbon in the ninth inning at Fenway. That's like one of my most replayable A-Rod moments for me as a Yankee, just going oppo against Papelbon, who was obviously, you know, a star at that time. And I think that was a 1-0 win. That was like the only run of the game on Sunday night.
Yeah, I went out with some friends like we used to do when we were younger. We were going to a diner like late at night after doing something, and I was, guys, I'll be in 1 minute. I just want to hear the ninth inning of the Yankee game, and I was sitting in the parking lot when A-Rod hit that homer of the Menlo Park Diner. Listen to John and Susan call it. But yeah, that was a big moment, and that really started to turn things around, because I think they went, what, like 16, they won 16 games in June. So that was really them starting to turn it around after the horrible April and May. And then in July, they just, you know, they caught fire. But, yeah, it was a weird year, too. I mean, you had the – A-Rod has a monster year. Roger Clemens comes back.
Yeah, you have the Clemens and George Steinbrenner's box incident. You have, like you said, A-Rod having a monster year. Posada had a monster year. You had the pitching rotation, an absolute mess in the beginning of the year. Keigawa was a complete nightmare. He went from the majors like straight to single A after he gave up however many runs it was in his first few starts as a Yankee after getting paid $46 million to come over here. And then you had, what, Jeff Karstens slid into the rotation and got hit with a line drive in the leg.
Yeah.
It was a wild year for the pitching staff. I do remember that. I think they had – they set some kind of record for, like, the most number of starting pitchers
used.
Let's see.
Well, we went to Phil Hughes came up that year. We went to his first start against the Blue Jays.
Yep. And then soon after that, he went 6 1/3 hitless innings against the Rangers.
And hurt himself.
Yep, pulled his hammy. I remember watching that game. But yeah, I remember being at his first career start. And
remember how excited everybody was for Ian Kennedy.
Yep.
Right? Phil Hughes and Jabba Chamberlain. That was going to be the future. They were going to have three aces.
Yeah. here it is. The Yankees set the major league record. They used 10 different starters in the first 30 games in 2007.
Well, that's not what you want.
Because Chinming Wong got hurt early in the year. Carl Pavano, big surprise, got hurt. This was a rough year for Mike Mussina.
Pavano started the home opener that year. Just opening day. I remember that. Dad took me to this restaurant called The Stadium, which is in sort of like on the way to your house. So we had to drive like past Yankee Stadium. He's like, I'm taking you somewhere. I'm going to surprise you. We're like, okay, cool. We're probably going to the game, right? So we drive past the GWB and just go to a restaurant. Like, I'm thankful for it. But, you know, if you're driving past the stadium on opening day, you're going to think you're going to opening day.
Yeah.
But we got to watch Carl Pavano pitch while we sat in a restaurant for 3 hours. So that was cool. Jeter hit a big home run on opening day, too. I remember that.
Yeah. And A-Rod had an absolute monster April.
Oh, forget it.
And speaking of big months, Hideki Matsui had a monster July. Didn't he hit like 13 home runs in July?
Matsui's one of those players. When you look, you don't remember like him having just huge years, period, but he has some great years when you go back and look at the Baseball Reference for the Yanks.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so then the Yankees are what, down 10 games by July 1st in the division, and pretty much the same. It's like 8 or 9 in the wild card by that point, and things aren't looking good.
They were 14.5 back on May 29th.
And I remember just the second half of that season being so much fun. It was just very Major League montage-esque, like, you know, following the standings and each win, and, you know, win after win, and suddenly the team is on fire. And I think I remember having like a little piece of paper in my locker in high school, and like I would go into school the next morning and update like how and write on the paper like how many games back they were, and I would cross off and it started at like 9 or something like that, and then, you know, before you know it, come September, they're back in a playoff spot.
That was awesome. And I mean, if you look on their Baseball Reference, like that, the bar chart they have of all the wins and everything and losses, it's just amazing when you look at past the All-Star break how few red dates there are. And it's funny how you remember things. Like, I got a job that summer. I was delivering pizza, so I got to listen to John and Susan every night while I was driving around. And I'm looking at this game where they beat the Devil Rays 17-5 in the second game of a doubleheader. And I remember that. They just were like murdering teams like that. Then the next night they won 21-4.
Yeah.
Then 9-2. They went on a roll, and they beat the White Sox 16-3. Then they won 16-8 against the Royals. Like, crazy stuff.
That 16-3 game against the White Sox was when they hit 8 home runs. Ozzie Guillen got thrown out. Everyone from Cano to Shelley Duncan went yard in that game.
Shelley Duncan. That's right. He had that crazy stretch in there.
Yep. So obviously a huge highlight of the season is Jabba. I mean, he became must-see TV, and it was – he had the Shout at the Devil song when he came out, and it was just like – it was like another version of Mariano and Enter Sandman, and just having them two in the back of the bullpen was so much fun. And, of course, there were the people that hated how pumped up he got after an out, which was probably just as – I don't really remember, but it was probably just as annoying to hear people complain about that back then as it is to hear people complain about bat flips now. But I just remember – being captivated by his run of just being so dominant and so animated on the mound. It was just, he was so much fun to watch, and he was just really refreshing. Obviously it's a shame how it turned out, but I know we both had Jabba Rules t-shirts.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, I was at the game where I think it was he struck out J.D. Drew with like runners on first and second or something like that against the Red Sox, and he went absolutely nuts, and that's what kind of started the whole thing. And I mean, I was a fan. I was just going absolutely crazy. I mean, you know, you love that stuff. It's, you know, I was a fan of Jabba from the beginning just because he brought so much energy and so much excitement into the game. And you have to remember where we were at that point with, you know, we had Kyle Farnsworth and you know, Tom Gordon did fine, but the bridge to Mariano was a huge problem for years. And that's why the Yankees lost in 2004. It wasn't because Mariano, it was because the bridge to Mariano was faulty and Mo got taxed. And then you get to 2007 and you're still having problems in the bullpen. And then Jabba comes up and just changes everything. And he changes the whole attitude of the team. And, I mean, for him, I would almost put him as my MVP of the 2007 Yankees if it wasn't for A-Rod.
I'd still put Posada, too, probably. But, yeah, I mean, Jabba was incredible. What, one earned run over over 24 innings? Yeah, one earned run over 24 innings. He was only 21 years old at the time. And like you said, aside from Mariano, there was Farnsworth, Brian Bruni, Mike Myers would come in to pitch to the Halloween theme song.
So oh, because he's Mike Myers.
Yeah, there wasn't really much to look forward to out of the bullpen until you got to Mo. So Jabba coming in was just so much fun. And just like, just another jolt of energy to a team that just kept climbing after, you know, once the calendar flipped to July. And get the wild card spot. They obviously couldn't catch up to Boston for the division, but they were able to seal the wild card spot. Are there any other regular season moments that pop in your mind? The big ones for me, like I said, was the A-Rod home run off Papelbon, the 8 home runs against the White Sox, A-Rod's 500th home run, youngest player in history to do it once he did.
The homer off Papelbon, you said.
Yeah.
I remember they were – right when they were like starting to take over, remember they were chasing the Mariners that year, I think, in for the wild card. And I went to a series against the Mariners, and they were losing 2-1. A-Rod hit 2 home runs in like the 7th inning. Like they batted around, he hit a home run to tie the game. They batted around, and then he hit one later in the inning. Seeing guy hit two, A-Rod hit 2 home runs in 1 inning that year. That was crazy. Chin-Ming Wong almost pitched a no-hitter against the Red Sox, which a game we were at.
Yeah, he had the big strikeout of Big Poppy in like the 6th or 7th inning or something like that to keep the no-hitter intact.
We almost were late that game. We almost missed a train. I remember we ran up the stairs. And Mom was asking, while Chin-Ming Wong has a no-hitter going against Boston, when are they going to bring Jabba in? That's how big Jabba was. That Mom didn't realize that Chin-Ming Wong was pitching a no-hitter and wanted to know when we're going to get to see Jabba.
That does perfectly encapsulate the Jabba craze.
And then Jabba, for some reason, that day, decided he hated Kevin Youkilis. Hated him. That was so weird.
Yeah, that was weird. I'm just
Didn't Schilling start for the Red Sox that game?
I think so.
Am I making that up? Cano hit 2 homers, right?
Yeah, Cano was blossoming into stardom at that point and quickly becoming my second favorite player on the Yankees aside from Jeter.
Imagine how much you like me who ran home.
Doesn't matter to me. former friend of the podcast, Ben Lindbergh, clearly wrote out how Cano's running only cost him like 4 infield singles a year. So I'll gladly give those up for a guy who played 160 games a year.
That's fair. It was Curt Schilling, by the way, that started. Oh, it's always great when Curt Schilling loses.
Yeah. Did you see on Twitter yesterday?
I didn't see it, but I got the alert from like Bleacher Report.
Yeah. For anyone who didn't see, someone tweeted at David Wells, who was someone in the majors that everyone else in the league seemed to universally hate. And Wells said Schilling.
Nice.
Yeah. So I guess before we get to the playoffs, I'm just looking at A-Rod's stat line, a 176 OPS plus, of course, the 54 home runs. He was just a monster. But again,
contract year too.
Yeah, he announces his opt-out during the World Series. But then again, Posada in his age 35 season, a 153 OPS plus. It's like I was saying to you the other day, when the MLB The Show announced that their new diamond player was 2000 Posada. It would be cool if there was like an evolution challenge in the game where you can get up to 2007 Posada and then his rating goes up like 7 points or something, because that's just how nasty he was that year.
Yeah, that would be pretty sick. And yeah, another guy in a contract year.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't even remember that.
Yeah. So and somebody else was in their walk year too. I know Pettit had only had a 1 year deal, I think, but
yeah,
maybe it was two. But anyway,
so the Yankees somehow win 94 games. They only finished 2 games back in the division. They almost it felt like 2017. Like if the season was another week or so longer, like they could have caught them. But they settle for the wild card and they go in and play Cleveland, who I believe they beat every time they faced them that year in the regular season. Weren't the Yankees like 6-0 against them?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're right.
So of course we're going in with confidence. The Yankees were one of the hottest teams in baseball. They're playing a team they hadn't lost to all regular season, and then they get absolutely demolished in game one going up against CeCe.
They outscored Cleveland 49-17 in the regular season.
And then lose 12-3 in game one.
Yeah, against CeCe. And I think Melky hit a home run in like the early in that game or something like that. Because I remember feeling very hopeful early on, and then just it all came undone.
Yeah, they scored in the top of the first. Maybe that was the Melky home run. I'm trying to look right now. No, it was Johnny Damon hitting a home run.
Lefty on lefty.
Against CeCe, and you're like, all right, here we go. And then Chin-Ming Wong comes in.
Chin-Ming Wong was a bad postseason pitcher.
Yeah, he definitely struggled in October, and this was certainly one of those times. He gave up 3 runs in the first inning.
Did he ever win except for the game when Jeter went 5-for-5?
I don't think so.
And even in that game, they scored 8 runs for him.
Yeah.
He lost game 2 in 05. Yeah, yeah. He stunk. Wow.
Yeah,
and I like Chin-Ming Wong in the regular season.
No, of course. He was great. So a much better pitching performance in game two, but the Yankees still weren't able to get it done. And this is when you bring up the 2007 season, this is the one everyone thinks about. It was the Midges game where Jabba couldn't throw a strike because he was being swarmed by a bunch of bugs. Joe Torre would later say it's his only regret as Yankee manager that he didn't pull the team off the field. And I just remember watching that, and obviously you don't think of it right away, but when I watched the highlights, I'm like, man, this was so surreal. Like, you had Jeter and A-Rod, like, spraying umpires with bug spray. Like, they were all helping each other out. It's like, didn't any of these guys, like, while doing this, be like, maybe we should just get off the field for a little bit?
Yeah, see, like, treat it like a rain delay? That probably would have been good.
But, of course, they didn't.
Yeah, they didn't. And
man, Jabba was yanking those breaking balls, just
yeah, probably getting like bit and stuff while he's doing that. They're all over him. I felt bad for Jabba for that, but
yeah, me too. He was holding a lead in the eighth inning, and then clearly affected by the bugs, throws that wild pitch. I think it was Grady Sizemore scored the tying run off that wild pitch. I can't believe he only wound up giving up 1 run.
Yeah, that's probably more incredible.
And to be fair, I think it was Fausto Carmona who was pitching that game. He came back out in the ninth, and the bugs were still there, and he pitched through it too.
Yeah, that's true.
But that was a game where Pettit pitched his heart out, and then these damn bugs come in and change the whole outlook of the game and maybe the series. I mean, if the Yankees go back to the Bronx tied 1 game apiece, it could look a lot different. What is with crazy things happening in game two in Cleveland of ALDSs? We, you know, 10 years later, we have Girardi not challenge a call that clearly needed to be challenged, and then immediately followed by a grand slam.
9 years before, game two against the Indians, this time in the Bronx.
Knobloch.
Yeah, game two against the Indians. Not good things.
So future Yankee teams, never get to game two if you're playing Cleveland.
Just forfeit. they could pitch Jay Happ that game. And just, you know, this way you just take an L and you'll be all right. But that was a classic Andy Pettit game in game two as well. I mean, he doesn't have his best stuff. Indians get 9 hits in total in that game. I'm not looking at Pettit's line right now, but, you know, he shuts him down, man. He gets him to the eighth inning scoreless. Just Andy Pettit being Andy Pettit. And that's the game Melky hit the home run in.
Yeah, I just pulled up Andy's line. He gave up 7 hits over 6 1/3. So, like you said, not his best stuff, but holds them scoreless in a game the Yankees have to have. That was classic Pettit.
Honestly, if my life is on the line and I need somebody to win, it's got to be Andy. Like, no matter how else you think about it, like, oh, well, this guy's better. This guy.
He's also been bombed sometimes when they need a win. I would pick El Duque.
When has he been bombed when they absolutely knew this was the game?
It would help to win game 6 of the 2000 World Series.
It would help, but they didn't. That wasn't a must-win game.
I mean, you can argue 98 was pretty important. They had just lost this crazy game where Knobloch, you know, had a brain fart, and he got rocked that game too. Well,
when Knobloch pulled a rock.
but anyway, back to this game. So then the Indians load the bases in the 11th. And Luis Vizcaíno's on the mound, who the Yankees got for Randy Johnson when they traded him back to the Diamondbacks in the offseason. And he just throws this meatball right down the middle to Travis Hafner. Yeah. He literally was a full count with the bases loaded. And you can just tell he was like, I'm just going to throw this right down the middle and hopefully he misses it.
And obviously he didn't. Hopefully the line drive goes right at first base. That's all you're hoping for. Oh boy. Yeah, that was a tough ending. That's one of those games you look back on and you think about what could have been different. But, like you said, Indians come out, they play through the bugs without giving up any runs. And, you know, the Yankees only got 3 hits that game. And that's crazy considering what the Yankees offense was like in 2007, that they only got 8 hits combined in the first 2 games in Cleveland.
I don't even remember who pitched game 2 for Cleveland. Who started for them?
I'm not sure.
I don't even remember.
Oh, Carmona.
No.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Gastel Carmona.
Was it?
Yeah.
Go figure. I didn't think he was still pitching by the 9th inning.
According to the Wikipedia, he started.
All right. Well, then we get to game 3.
This is one of the more underrated games. And I'm not saying it because I was there. I'm like Mike Francesa. I was in the building.
Yeah.
But
no, this was a great game. I mean, the Yankees had just lost in heartbreaking fashion to go down 2-0 in the series, and then they fall behind 3-0 in the game, and you're like, all right.
The big thing was too, the morning of this game, it's on the cover of the Post and the Daily News that if they lose, Torrey's getting fired. And that adds like this whole other thing to all of this. And I remember I went to the game with my friends Alex and Vinny, and we're talking about like who's going to be the next manager. Is it going to be like Larry Boa? Or I remember that was a name that got thrown out there. Joe Girardi. And it's just like, wow, I can't believe this might come to an end. And then they go down 3-0 and Roger Clemens ain't got – jack shit.
No.
And as usual, Trot Nixon hits a home run off of him.
Yeah. But then luckily Phil Hughes comes in.
Save the day, I guess.
But obviously the story of the game was Johnny Damon. I think he had 4 RBIs. Obviously he had at least 3 because he hit the big 3-run home run to give the Yankees the lead.
Yeah, he had 4. Melky had an RBI single right before Damon hit the 3-run homer to cut it to 3-2. But Damon got them on the board, and then Damon hits a home run. And honestly, like just like for myself, I was sitting in the upper deck. That is the only time, and I'm glad I got to do it. It's the last playoff win at Yankee Stadium. But when Damon hit that home run, you could actually feel the thing shake, like people had talked about, and I was really happy I got to feel that. One time in my life. So that was really cool. And then I think it was the next inning, Cano was up with the bases loaded and hit one to right field. And Nixon just overran it and the ball rolled behind him all the way to the wall. And it was a bases clearing triple for Cano. And then they were on their way. Hughes pitches great, shuts them down for like 3 2/3. And Jabba comes in, gave up a run. They bring in Mo, and that's it. That's the last win in the old Yankee Stadium in the postseason. Joe Torre's last win as a Yankee, and that was really it. Then
Chiming Wong comes back in for game 4.
Would you have went to Mussina here?
No, to be honest, I don't think I would have. I mean, Chiming Wong had been really good, and I don't know. I just don't know if I could have just saw his one bad start in game one and just not trusted him again. Maybe I would have had a I mean, but he had a short leash on him anyway. Maybe I just would have not brought him back for the second inning. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not like Moose was incredibly sharp either. He walked four guys in 4 2/3 innings.
Yeah, and he gave up 2 runs, which proved to be the difference. Look at the hit totals for this game. Yankees got 12 hits and only scored 4 runs.
Yep.
Can you take a couple walks?
Cleveland had 13.
This is
6.
Incredible. The Yankees hit 3 home runs, had 12 hits, and only scored 4 runs. They couldn't string any of this together. You know what I remember about this game? They were rolling. I think it was like the 5th or 6th inning. They were getting it going, and Jeter ran into a double play. And when that happened,
I remember that.
When like that, they were you could tell it was starting to be one of those Yankee Stadium things. Moments you could tell when the double play happened, you just knew it wasn't the year. They weren't going to do it, because if it was a year they were going to win, Jeter would have come through with a big hit there.
Yeah, no, I remember that, because Shelley Duncan and Johnny Damon had back to back hits, and then Jeter bounced into that double play.
Yeah.
Yep. That was rough. But my boy Cano, another multi-hit game.
Too. What'd you say?
I said my boy Cano had another multi-hit game in game
four. He hit a homer.
He had a big series.
Yeah, he did.
The rest of the offense did not, except Johnny Damon in game three.
Yeah, really odd showing by the offense, considering what happened in the regular season. But it was pretty crazy.
Yeah, it was a crazy year. Came to an unceremonious end with Chinming Wong on the mound. But again, still a fun year. I mean, that kind of was – everyone was like, oh, the dynasty's in transition after this year, because A-Rod opts out. They move on from Joe Torre. And then everyone's like, all right, maybe this is the end of, like, the dominant playoffs every year Yankees as we know it. They missed the postseason in 2008 and then – not going to really say anything about it, because I'm sure we're going to talk about this season in the future, but then they come back and win it all in 2009.
Yeah, it's weird. Like certain seasons definitely feel like they have specific endings, and this one's no different, because you change managers and Joe Torre, who had been absolutely incredible for the Yankees. And but at the same time, I think I don't know. Aside from the manager, what do you really lose between seasons, right? Like 2008, they're too old. Like besides Clemens, you really don't lose anything player wise.
Yeah, and you kind of get something back, because Moose wound up being really good in 2008 to make up absolutely for 2007. Incredible. So yeah, there's just an old team.
They had one great run in them, and they gave us a really, really fun summer. That was one of the more fun summers I had watched baseball. This one was one, too, in 2019 with the next man up thing. It was like, how does this keep happening? And 2007 was like that, too. It wasn't next man up, but it's like, how do they keep winning this many games at this rate? Like, this is incredible. And they're pounding teams in the second half.
Yeah,
so,
it was
really fun.
One of the most enjoyable regular seasons, I think. Like you said, 2019 stands out, 2017 stands out for me, and like, oh, wow, these guys are good a lot earlier than I thought. This was kind of like, wow, these guys are somehow still winning after this awful start. And it was, yeah, like you said, it was one of those summers where you get off school and you're looking forward to watching the game that night, because they all meant something. It wasn't like it was when we were younger, where by July or August, you're like, okay, when did the playoffs start?
Yeah, that's true. But then the next year they don't make the playoffs, and then I'm like, I'll never complain again if
they're
not a pennant race. I'm good. Just wrap it up, just so I know. I get to October.
All right, who picked this one? I don't even remember.
You did.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So then you're up next. What year are we talking about next week?
I was going to pick 01. So if you want to pick again, since we got to do the one I was going to pick, because we had Kirchin on last week, you could pick again.
I didn't even think about it. All right, so that was 2007. I guess I'll back it up and go 2003.
Okay, that's what I was going to pick anyway, so that's awesome.
All right, cool, perfect. So there you go. That's what we're going to be talking about next week, 2003. Thank you to everyone for listening this week. Thank you to Peter Boddy. Again, everyone, make sure to go get that book. It's a good one. It's fun to read. It's cool to look back on all the historic players and moments and read a little bit about Seinfeld as well. So thanks again to Peter. Thanks to everyone again for listening, and we will talk to everyone next week.
See you later, everybody.